Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele. Yes, I'm still here. I'm still fighting the good fight. And I sent out for reinforcements. Yes, I refuse to do this by myself. In fact, I'll follow this guy into the fight any day of the week. He's our guest for this conversation today, the incredible Bill Kristol. The director of Defending Democracy Together. He is also editor-at-large of the news and opinion website, The Bulwark, which if you don't have it, you don't get it, you've got to. Some really smart, high-end intellectual stuff on that site. He was a founder of the Weekly Standard, and as a regular guest, we get to appear from time to time on MSNBC, and he's on other networks as well. And prior to his work at the Weekly Standard, he led the Project for the Republican Future, an organization that helped shape the strategy that produced the 1994 Republican congressional victory. He probably gets blamed for that a lot, just like I get blamed for the success of 2010. It's like, damn it, why did you guys do all that winning? I'm like, oh, okay, because that's what we do. Bill, welcome.
Well, it's good to be with you, Michael, and I admire what you've been doing these last several years as well, of course, and we've talked many times, but if I'm the reinforcements you're waiting for, I think we're in trouble. Let me just begin with that, by stipulating that, you know?
Well, you know, and I'm going to tell you why I look at you that way. Bill and I are working together on a number of projects right now that are democracy-centered, because both of us believe the country is despite what some may think, still a center-right nation, and that a lot of the values and ideas that we have fought for and put in front of the country still have merit and value. And it got me thinking, Bill, as I was, you know, going through, okay, what I want to talk to Bill about, because there's a lot, and I don't want to do the traditional, oh, Bill, what's the future of the Republican Party? You know, I'm like so sick of that question. But there is an aspect of it that I don't think has gotten a lot of consideration, and it's right in your wheelhouse, and that is the intellectual side. It's not so much the future of the party, but what is the intellectual conversation we should have, the philosophical, the ideas that we as conservatives and as Republicans, irrespective of the, quote, GOP and the RNC and all of that, what should we be saying to the country right now, or what could we be saying to the country?
I mean, what was conservatism conserving, Michael? You and I were part of that movement for a long time. And I think the right. core thing that it was trying to conserve was liberal democracy in America, freedom in America, whether that meant free markets, obviously not 100%, you know, with a welfare state, with a safety net, with appropriate regulations, but basically a preference for free markets, certainly a preference, not more than a preference, a commitment to free speech, to freedom of thought, freedom of action. And a preference for helping those fighting for freedom elsewhere around the world, though people differed on exactly how to do that. And so I think those are all important things. They are things that many liberals have shared, but we've differed on the means. But at times, I think the American conservative movement, the American conservative movement has a lot to be proud of over decades in standing up for freedom and in thinking through how to strengthen the institutions of freedom, not just say we're for freedom, you know, or we believe in the First Amendment, but to really think about, well, what social conditions, what cultural conditions, right. what other institutions, federalism, decentralization, you know, would strengthen civil society, would strengthen the forces of a decent and free society. And that remains the same intellectual challenge, political challenge it's always been. But the degree to which current American conservatism is just given up. It was already getting stale. I think we all sensed that in the early 2010, you know, mm-hmm. last 10 years ago, let's say. There wasn't as much fresh thinking. We were probably guilty of that, as along with others, as there could have been. But it's one thing to be a little stale or to be, you know, saying, gee, we need to think through these, how to deal with social media, how to deal with this new world, how to deal with China. Those are challenges. They require fresh thinking. They're going to lead to differences of judgment. That's very different from just ignoring these challenges or just demagoguing them. And for me, that's what has conservatism stood for more than anything else, in my opinion, hostility to and fear of and repudiation of demagoguery. That is the flaw of that can really drive a democracy over the cliff, the kind of pandering to the lowest passions, anxieties, prejudices. And we've seen it in spades in the last 5 years, and conservatism has just gone along with it. And I would even say, legitimated it and enabled it.
is intellectual conservatism gone? I mean, is it dead? Has it been supplanted by this sort of populism or populist conservatism, as some now are trying to call it, which is void from what I can see of any intellectual integrity. I mean, what is that grounding thing that you believe? Absent that, what is this now? What are we seeing? And how do you take what you and I have been talking about and working on? How do you take that and get it in front of this thing that seems to be the order of the day?
Yeah, I haven't given up exactly on the term conservatism or the conservative movement, but I guess I use it much less than I used to. And I get impatient. You said earlier, correctly, I'm sort of sick of discussions about the future of the Republican Party, not because it's not important, of course, but because it's just, we feel like that's all been said a million times. I'm sort of sick of people saying we've got to save the conservative movement. And
right.
You know what? We need to save liberal democracy, and we need to make the right arguments and find the right policies and do the right things. And if people, a lot of those judgments will be informed by the best conservative thinkers of the past and of the present. But I don't know if the ism is really worth defending anymore, because conservatism at some point becomes what conservatives, self-described conservatives, say and do, right? And if these conservatives are busy justifying January 6th and justifying pure demagoguery and pandering to nativism and authoritarianism, I guess we could say till we're blue in the face, and we have said, that's not Edmund Burke's conservatism. That's not Bill Buckley's conservatism. But
right.
At some point, it's like, okay, it's a matter of, I suppose, terminology or definition. And I do think also some liberals have risen to the occasion. They are people on liberals who are opposing the left, who are opposing the attempts to shut down free speech on campus. And I do think that center-right, center-left coalition, frankly, offers more hope for the future, probably. Yeah. Than all of us scrambling to sort of get back in front of some populist movement that has to be checked. We have to think through how to obviously attract people from it. You've done a lot of thinking about that because you were in real politics more than I, in elective politics. But again, I don't think obsessing about conservatism as a thing is a particularly healthy way to go. The question, what do we do about social media? What do we do about China? Those are questions that we should really debate without sort of having symposia that say, I said this to someone the other day, let's not have symposia about what should the conservative position on China be. Let's just have a symposium on what's the intelligent position of dealing with China as a foreign policy threat, And if liberals are on board with a lot of that, that's great. And if some liberal foreign policy person has thought through something better than a conservative foreign policy intellectual, that's fine too.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the interesting challenge, I think, in this space right now, is redefining the way we approach the narrative, because the instinct is to sort of fall back on, as you noted, what is conservatism and what is the future of it? And you're sitting there going, okay, so we are like so past that right now. The point now is, how do we address these ideas that are out there regarding China and trade and healthcare and all of these issues? And in that discourse, you begin to seed the center right narrative around how you would solve those problems. Yeah, you may bring some elements from a bygone era, if you will, of conservatism, but there is a new way of thinking about these things. And I think you put your finger on it. It's in that space where the center left and the center right come to and try to work towards a consensus that is based off of past experiences and past intellectual study, et cetera, that's now being redesigned to confront a different reality. And I think it's one of the challenges that candidates running in the upcoming elections, for federal office especially, are going to find themselves in. Because what's your go-to if you're a Trump Republican running for the United States Senate? what did you just start beating
the
drum?
We know the answer to that.
I hate Russia. I love Russia and I hate China.
No, the go-to is I hate Biden. I hate the left. I hate the liberals. They are endangering America. I mean, it's become a purely negative movement. I mean, God knows you and I are familiar with practical politics, and that a lot of politics is about, you know, criticizing your opponents as opposed to necessarily promoting your own ideas, or in addition to promoting your own ideas, hopefully. But the degree, the balance now is so unbelievably lopsided that there's been no coming to account. This, for me, is the big story of the last 3-4 months. I mean, there's been no coming to grips with the Trump, with 4 years of Donald Trump, with his legacy, even with January 6th, even with the big lie. I mean, that's kind of, and that tells you a lot, tells me a lot. I mean, I think we all sort of hoped, I was skeptical, but I was hopeful that after November 3rd, maybe after December 14th, maybe after January 6th, there'd be a moment of, oh my God, we've got to at least, you know, people aren't going to go apologize and abase themselves, fine, but they're going to sort of make, say, this was enough of that. We're really a fresh start. They haven't said that, which means I think we're kind of on our own, as you say, a new territory, new waters, intellectually and politically. We've got to think it through. And, you know, I think in practical terms for 2022, since you alluded to federal candidates, I'm very curious what you think about this. We've been having a debate at the Bulwark. I'm sure you've seen the pieces. You know, what's more hopeful, running in Republican primaries, running in Democratic primaries, conceivable independent candidacies or third parties? I've been sort of more open, I'd say, to the Democratic side, but also just agnostic in the sense that I think we should help good people wherever they are.
See, that's
very fine. Different situations are very different. What happens in Maryland is different from what happens in Georgia. And you just need to sort of look at the practical questions of getting decent people into office or helping them make a good contest of it. But what's your sense of that?
Yeah, I come from a very different space, which actually kind of winds up where you are. Given that I'm the guy that actually not only supported but endorsed Joe Biden for president, the idea for me of cross-pollinization of our politics is alive and well. In other words, if you find a good candidate on the Democratic side who is espousing solid Democratic principles and ideas, yeah, we can have the dance around whether or not you kill the XL pipeline or what you do at the border. But for me, at this point in our history, we need affirmation that democracy matters. We need affirmation from these candidates that they will not look at the racial tensions and white supremacy and conclude, oh, they're fine people on both sides. We need candidates who will look at the health of this nation and be prepared to step in to save families and to support those families and not dicker over, it's just going to cost us too much money to extend someone's rent payment. So that for me is going to be a real big driver in the upcoming election. So, yeah, there are going to be some Democrats out there that are going to make a lot more sense to me than maybe they otherwise would have because I had the previous blinders on, you know, from a purely partisan perspective. And as someone who has been endorsed by Democrats for elective office, as someone who's endorsed a Democrat for elective office, I'm much more comfortable now in that space than I probably have ever been in my life. And I'll be honest, I'm going to share a little something I have not shared with you before. I actually kind of watched you because I have a great deal of regard and respect for you. And as we've laughed about, we've had our battles in the past. But at the end of the day, I knew you were a solid, and I'll put it this way, a solid conservative. You're a guy who stood on principle. So I've watched how you've navigated this space and have been impressed with how you come out of it. And it's still anchored around convictions. And you still have the views you have on certain policies, but the strongest thread in all of that is your belief in the country and the republic and those principles that have built this country and that you now think are going to be important to transforming it and making it better. And that to me is the kind of voice that I think we're going to need to see and hear from candidates and the big thinkers going forward. Because if you just leave it to the isms, whether it's Trumpism, conservatism, liberalism, then you're playing on old ground. You're playing on dirty, you know, to mix a crazy metaphor, dirty soil, right? It's rocky. It's not growing anything new. And how do you stay in that space given the tug and the pull to get to the lowest common denominator on some of these things, and to, you know, yeah, you may have supported, you know, Joe, or you may have, you know, liked this Democrat, but at the end of the day, you know, you got to come back home and you know, start beating that war drum again. I mean, how do we navigate that going forward? Because that's going to be the temptation.
Yeah, no, and a lot of our friends, I think, are you can see the pull of it, and I don't, you know, begrudge people that. People have been part of something for a long time, and you were chairman of the party. I mean, much more than most of these people, you must feel it a lot, and a lot of people say that to you, you know. Well, so thanks for the kind words, A. B, I totally agree with you. I liked your formulation about the isms. I think that is the main thing we've got to get beyond. Progressivism, conservatism, I mean, obviously they exist, they're movements, intellectual historians will write books about them, but I think at this moment in 2021, we need to think through what's good for the country, what's good for liberal democracy. Don't be scared if someone says, gee, that sounds pretty progressive to have the federal government step in and make sure people can exercise voting rights. Well, look, you know what? Maybe we wouldn't have been for that 20 years ago. Maybe it wasn't necessary, because maybe 20 years ago, Republican state legislatures weren't trying to roll back the accessibility to the ballot that people exercised last year. I mean, for me, that's such a core question. Was 2020 a success story in the sense that in the middle of a pandemic, more people voted, a higher percentage of people voted than what, in a century, I think, in a fair and free election with big turnout across all groups, and incidentally, not just liberals and Democratic groups, you know, Trump voters turned out in huge numbers, as Trump himself keeps saying, right?
He got a right. He keeps reminding us.
So it was, that's good, right? Now, so therefore, let's look at what happened. Let's think about, you know, maybe tweak, of course, some of the things that were pandemic specific and so forth. But there's just the degree to which, I was on TV last night about this, I mean, the degree to which the Republicans aren't even pretending anymore that they're sort of interested in, well, let's be a little careful because certain election processes are better than others. You know, that's fine, but that's not it. That's not what's going on. It's purely an attempt to suppress Democratic votes in 2022. Right. Well, and that's bad. I mean, that has to be opposed. And I think there I'd even, you know, that's why I'm sympathetic to maybe breaking the filibuster, even for the voting rights matters, because that's, and I think maybe redistricting as well, because that's a matter of such urgency. That doesn't mean that we should pass every big government bill that Biden wants to propose or that the liberals in Congress want to propose. So I don't know. Can we sort of sustain that kind of attitude going forward? You know, it's interesting. On the practical side, I've had a lot of young people you know, get in touch with me as they do with you, thinking of running for office. You know, you've actually run and won. I've just been close to it. But, you know, what should I do? I'm a never Republican type. A lot of these have served in the military, actually, you know, in their 30s. But, you know, they don't like Trump. They don't want to be part of some nativist authoritarian party. They served in a military that was not, that was full of very diverse people, and they're proud of that, and they don't want a sort of some ridiculous vision of America that goes back 50 years and isn't even accurate about what it was like then, you know. And what should they do? And I try to give them decent advice, but a lot of that advice is A, do what you think is right, and B, take a look at the local circumstances. In some places, running as a Republican might be sensible, and others running as a moderate Democrat might be sensible, and others maybe spending time with your family and building up a little nest egg might be sensible, because you know, maybe you'd be better off in 4, 6, or 8 years. But you don't want to discourage good people from getting into politics at all. I really don't. I think it's important they get in, but you also got to do it with your eyes open. And I tell them this is a very unusual time. I mean, you could run as one thing now and be something else 4 years later, you know, when Lincoln was away and ended up as a Republican. I volunteered for Scoop Jackson when I was in college. I worked for Pat Moynihan in the summer of 76 for a couple of months when I was in grad school. Became a Reagan Republican. At the time, a lot of people were moving back and forth, and no one thought that was a terrible thing. If you're growing up, you change your mind a little bit. The parties change a little bit. And I think having a little more of that attitude, too, of, you know, let's try to do what's right for the country, and that might mean different things. That Ronald Reagan changed parties, right? So I think that attitude's pretty easy to say in general, to express in general. But in practice, it does pose real challenges for people, especially, frankly, younger people, I think, who, you know, there's no obvious path the way there was 20 years ago. Sign up with the Republican Party and you get this position and you get to know that big shot and then you move up the chain. Right. And What about you? So I hear, I read that are you thinking of doing something in Maryland?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. And, you know, but there's a real price extracted now. I mean, like you, I'm having these conversations with individuals who are looking at running and I'm considering a run myself for governor here in Maryland, or maybe as you know, I've recently concluded, perhaps a 2024 run for the U.S. Senate. But the realities are, even in a state like Maryland, which is 2-1 Democrat, you still got to get through a Republican primary.
Yeah.
Dave Bossy is our national committee man here in Maryland. And, you know, Dave and
I don't have an open primary, unlike us in Virginia.
No. Yeah, no, heaven, no. And Dave is a buddy, a good guy. But, you know, I know where his loyalties lie. And I know where a lot of these guys, who were very, very strong in support of Trump. Governor Hogan was not. And that was successful. That was a successful formula for him. And man has 70% approval in a state that is very strongly Democratic. And that is the part and the challenge for a lot of these candidates to figure out, assessing what the ground game is in their state. Where is the state Republican Party? And what are the elements that are driving that? And yeah, okay, I can have a tough primary, but I can have a fairly competitive general election. Or do I get just overwhelmed in the primary and don't even make it to the general? And then the party's putting forth someone who wouldn't stand a chance in a general election. So these are the dynamics that everybody's kind of considering right now. And a friend of mine put it very, very well the other day. His former chairman of the DC party, and his response was, what he is anticipating is the emotional level of the next cycle is going to be something that is going to have an impact on races, because of this will be the first election, the campaigns after Trump's loss. So the emotions are going to be high and the engagement is going to be, kind of coming at you. And candidates need to assess that. Do you want to spend that capital on that kind of a race where you're not even getting past the emotional point to make a case for your candidacy, because you're either on the offense or the defense around Donald Trump emotionalism, just people just kind of reacting to that. And then you got to, you factor in, on the Democratic side, looking at, particularly Senate races and House races, the hesitancy to support a Republican candidate, because that may tip the balance of power against them. And so you have all these dynamics that I think to the candidates you're talking to and the candidates I'm talking to, you got to weigh it very carefully, because it may not play out so much at, in statewide races or local races, but in federal races, it's going to be a very big consideration for a lot of candidates, because, you're talking about 5 seats in the House, one seat change in the Senate, and all of a sudden, the whole balance of power shifts. That part of this, I think, you can get lost in that. And what we were talking about before is not so much the narrative you're going to take to the people, but you're going to be out there as a candidate sort of defending why you didn't support Trump or why you did support Trump. and what you want to do as a senator or what you want to do as a governor is not so much the conversation.
I think the important point you make though, and this really people should think about this, if people thinking of running should listen to this conversation, is I think the federal races are different from the state and local races. Mm-hmm. And I was having a talk with a young woman, actually, who's thinking of running, and she wants to be a Republican because that's kind of where she is on national security and things. But she doesn't like Trump. She thinks she can handle the, you didn't like Trump much. She wasn't in office. She was not particularly involved. She's busy doing other things. So she can sort of say, look, that's the past. What about the future? But then, of course, the question is, well, will you, if you win your House primary and general election, you'll support your Republican, you'll support Kevin McCarthy for Speaker, right? And she said, I guess that's what, if you're a Republican. And people will then say to you, well, he voted to overturn the election. Is that really acceptable to have the next speaker be someone who voted that way on January, on the evening of January 6th? And I would have, and this is the problem even I think we're facing too, in terms of, not that we matter much in terms of supporting people, but I mean, you know, do you want, you root for a good Republican? That's, I think we should help, which we're, Sarah Longwell and I, as you know, are helping the, trying to help the 10 Republicans in the House who voted to impeach. But on the other hand, if insofar as they're sticking with kind of Kevin McCarthy and with the Republican conference, you're putting an awful lot of people in charge of committees and in charge of Congress whom you're not really comfortable having there. So it's a genuine, I mean, people shouldn't, there are no formulas to solve this. Right. It's a genuine That's set of thing. Dilemmas. I do think at the state and local level, you know, you were a lieutenant governor. I mean, you can run as governor and just say, look, those are federal issues and I can't control
them. Exactly.
I'm going to do a good job here in Maryland. And it does give you more of a chance to, you know, articulate your own vision and your own ideas and sort of liberate yourself maybe from this kind of being in thrall to either, you know, the one of the two, one or the other of the national parties.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the dynamic, and candidates should understand that and be clear about it. A federal race in the upcoming cycle is going to be different from a state race at any level. But there are some elements that will cross over between the two, and you just need to be cognizant as a candidate of how you talk about, convey your thinking around that. You don't have to worry about Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House if you're running for the state legislature, but if you're running for Congress, you do. And if you're running,
even so, as you say, I mean. And even if you're running for the state legislature or secretary of state, let's say you do have to actually, it turns out this is one of the crazy things about Trump. Everything's become so personalized around him and around what you think about him and his control of the party that Brad Raffensperger, just to take a now famous name, running for an office where no one would have thought to ask his opinions on national issues, except vaguely kind of he's a Republican or Democrat or something.
But
now, in fact, it'll become a referendum, I suppose, on the 2020 election. So that would be a slight case for maybe for people, you know, that this is going to be kind of a crazy year. And on the other hand, if you don't jump in, if people don't jump in, you know, every year is going to look like a crazy year. People have to jump in at some point and do their best, right? And I always do try to remind people that most successful politicians have lost a race or two on the course and on their way up. Barack Obama really don't even know this, I find. Barack Obama was a state legislator in Illinois, not a particularly famous one even, and just and runs in a primary in 2000 against Chicago Congressman Bobby Rush.
That's right.
Who's the Democratic incumbent, and I think liked in the district. Well, obviously was, because he beat Obama 2-1. Think of this. You went in a primary, you lose 2-1, and it's kind of humiliating, right? You'd say in the normal, well, you're finished. I mean, you can't do, you take on the sitting congressman, a member of Congress, you lose 2-1. 4 years later, he's the Senate nominee, and 8 years later, he's president. So people really, it's, you know, these things are sort of unpredictable, and at some point people overthink them, and you just got to sort of do what you think is right and take a shot. And a lot of that depends on people's
purpose. At some point they stop talking to guys like you and me and go, oh, hell, I'm just going to go do it.
No, which is good. And a lot depends. I always tell this to them, you know, kind of on people's personal circumstances. What's their family situation, their financial situation? They shouldn't take out loans and, you know, and hope that they're going to win in a, if they're Republicans at a D plus 30 seat. But I mean, if they can do it consistent with their other obligations, it is worth taking a shot often.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and give Bill a chance to get ready for the next round. We'll be back with more with Bill Kristol right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and we're having a great conversation with my buddy Bill Kristol. Bill is the host of the podcast Conversations with Bill Kristol. He is founder of the Weekly was the founder of the Weekly Standard, and now is the editor at large of the news and opinion website The Bulwark, which you have to check out. So, Bill, what's your thoughts? Let's get on a little bit of a policy. Well, actually, before I do that, because you I wanted to zero in on the point you made about the filibuster. What is your take on the strategy here? Now, just I'll put on front of you my view real quick. I'm a student of the long game and consequences. So for me, if I'm going to make that kind of move, even if I'm going to make it for something as narrow as we're going to on voting rights, we're going to, you know, or the Voting Rights Act, we're going to, you know, do away with the filibuster, et cetera. It does open the door. And so precedentially, you've got to be prepared for what the Republicans will do the next time around. And so I get the caution that Biden and Schumer are exhibiting right now to the chagrin and frustration of their left flank. But what's your take on how this should play out? And what are the disadvantages or maybe even advantages that could come from it?
Yeah, I'm, you know, cautious about it also. And it's why I certainly wouldn't sort of, I'm just dubious about the filibuster as an overall institution in the Senate. I don't really think it increases compromise or moderation much. But leaving that aside, it exists. It has constrained both parties. And as a conservative with a small C, one probably should be a little cautious about changing things that have existed for a while, even if it's 30 or 40 years, not 200 years, obviously.
Right.
I do think the voting rights situation is urgent enough that it justifies, and redistricting probably, that it justifies looking for an exception for that. Now, it does open the door. There's no question. On the other hand, it's a little hard to say to Democrats, you know, Mitch McConnell gets to confirm Supreme Court justices for lifetime, with 51, 52 votes, and jam them through, you know, in the last month before presidential election, having stopped Garland and so forth. And you don't get to pass something that will really preserve people's right to vote or make it a lot easier, as it was in 2020, you know, because of the filibuster. I'm friendly to breaking the filibuster, especially on the voting redistricting issues. Mm-hmm. Now, look, it's the problem right now isn't what you say, what I say. It's what Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema say and whether they're willing to go along. And that's a persuasion question and a political question for Biden and Schumer. I do think H.R. 1, I had this argument with someone yesterday.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think, I mean, look, maybe that's the hand we've got to play. And at some point, people like, they're just going to go for that. And people like you and I, not that I suppose we'll have much influence at that point, we'll have to say yes or no. We would be for breaking the filibuster for that or for passing that whole bill. But I do think it muddies the waters because there's a lot of stuff in there. Some of it's okay, ethics in government, your tax returns. Some of it's dubious, I would say. The ACLU is against parts of it for curtailing speech, requiring you to make your name public if you give money to even to something like the Heading Democracy Together, if it spends any money on elections. So I'm not friendly, not a big fan of that part of it. Public financing, that's something that I've never been a big fan of at the federal level, at least. Mm-hmm. So I just think they would have a much cleaner argument if they took the voting provisions of H.R. 1, made them maybe a little less prescriptive. We don't need to tell every state exactly how many days of early voting they have. Just make sure there's enough to sort of let people vote. And the same with how they run the absentee and so forth. Put in the John Lewis Voting Rights Act stuff.
Right.
Make that the Emergency Voting Rights Act.
Right.
You'd have a case, and I think people like me in good faith would say, yeah, this is one where you really need to. You cannot let the fact that Republicans are digging in on this, let Arizona and these other states, Georgia, curb voting rights. So that would be, I prefer the narrower, slimmer H.R. 1, voting rights focused version of H.R. 1, maybe add in H.R. 4, which is the John Lewis Act. Right. And then if they give Republicans a chance to debate it and vote on it, I mean, let's see what happens.
Sure, see what happens with it.
Maybe some of them will. But if they don't, I think that would be the way to lay the predicate for doing it in the best way.
How do you assess Biden at this point? I have to give him kudos on a number of levels. From his approach to the pandemic, which has been consistent, and I guess it's just refreshing to hear, you know, someone just kind of say, okay, let me just tell you the real truth here, and this is what it is, and then back it up with demonstrable evidence. But how do you assess where Biden is as president, some, you know, 70, 80 days in?
No, I think it's been impressive. I mean, there are things I would do a tiny bit differently. I hope they can get some more people confirmed. I've talked to people in there, and I mean, they just don't have many assistant secretaries and stuff yet. And that's, and, you know, that's hard to run these agencies, and they got a ton of things to deal with. So, but on the whole, I think impressive. You know, I was looking this morning at some stuff online. Europe is going back into some shutdowns where the new variants and they've let it get a little out of control. They haven't done a very good job on the vaccines. And so at the end of the day, under Trump, I'd say we underperformed compared to Europe in terms of the pandemic. We had a higher death rate than much of Europe. And now with Biden, we're overperforming. So that's a pretty simple index. And it's a little oversimple because, of course, some of the things Biden's doing, Trump started and so forth. But I think that's a fair way to praise Biden. And I think, again, the stimulus, whatever it was, the economic relief package wasn't perfect, but it will end up doing good, doing some good. And he's been sober and a good model of how a president should behave, a good contrast with Trump. And his numbers are good. His popularity is good, which is good for him going forward. He has some political capital. So it's been good for the country, I think. So I'm quite impressed with the Biden presidency, as I was with the campaign. Now, having said that, the one thing I will say, I was thinking about this last night. I mean, they are facing a ton of challenges. I mean, people who are sort of thinking, yeah, Biden's done great. And, you know, he got the COVID thing out there. And but I mean, if you think about everything from the voting rights issues to immigration to climate change to just a ton of regular kind of healthcare, you know, the normal issues that deal with. And then the kinds of surprises, the border, the kinds of things that happen that you can't quite control, the world we're in. I mean, it's going to be, you know, they're going to have their hands full. I'm sure they'll mess up one or two things or in retrospect make some decisions that weren't perfect. But I think both he personally has done well. The administration seems pretty competent, pretty well organized, pretty focused on the big things, isn't getting too distracted by, you know, little fights, pretty high quality people in there. So, no, I'm pretty impressed.
How's he done at the border? How do you assess that right now, given the influx of El Salvadorians, Guatemalan children coming across the border, and you just get the sense that a lot of the Trumpists are sitting there just waiting to say, "Gotcha, told you so." See, you know, where are those cages? You know, how do you assess this storyline, because it's dominating right now. It is tricky on a good day, given the huge influx of these young people coming in and the lack of facilities to really accommodate and house them, which they seem to have figured out a way to start to do that. But, you know, now you're playing catch up. How is your assessment of that in light of what you was just saying about overall? But noting, hey, yeah, there are going to be some hiccups, and this may be one of them.
Yeah, and some things you just can't control, really, and also some things that Trump left you in a very bad situation to deal with, including the failure to cooperate. I mean, I was in government when we on our way out for the George H.W. Bush administration.
Right.
And the failure to cooperate in the transition, which is kind of an inside baseball thing, no one pays attention to it. Everyone's forgotten about, frankly, because of January 6th becoming the dominant story, as it should be, of those months. But it does make it harder just to get going. And the fact is DHS was not cooperative. Everyone agrees on this, I think, and which meant they couldn't really, it turns out they need a lot. I talked to Elizabeth Newman, who worked there. I mean, they need a lot more resources, but they didn't kind of realize that quite right away. They probably should now have gone to Congress and gotten some more quickly. And I guess now they are doing some things with, you know, to house these refugees and people who are coming across the border without documents and treat the kids in a humane way, but also figure out how to get them back with their parents. It's not easy. I think I wouldn't panic. I mean, I think they've got, you know, from a political point of view, Fox can scream and yell about it, but it will, what matters is how they deal with it over the next weeks and months. And I think most sane people understand that you can't, these things are challenging and they're going to look bad for now and will be a little bad for now, honestly, but that doesn't mean that they can't recoup. And they do seem to be sort of, I think they're very aware that they can't let it just go on for weeks and months this way. So, but these are real challenges in the real world. I mean, I was in the federal government, you were in the state government. I mean, it's not like you can just snap your fingers and fix certain things.
No.
And so but I think showing seriousness, not minimizing it, not politicizing it to the degree they can't, go to Congress if you need some resources and then let the Republicans scream and yell. But at the end of the day, are you going to give people resources to build the facilities they need near the border or not, and or hire the people they need? And not just, you know, border patrol officers, but also health, you know, workers and others to help. So I think you can be humane, but also, you know, but also enforce the law.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what they have to do. But it's going to be a challenge. And there's no question. There will be total demagoguery on Fox and on I mean, isn't that something that strikes you too, that the degree to which one hoped the fever might break a little with Trump, but I would say it's gotten worse. Yeah. I mean, my sense is that Fox and the right-wing echo chamber and the members of Congress themselves are being less responsible in a way than they were when Trump was there. Not yeah. more than yeah. the cheap demagoguery of some of these senators. And it's really terrible. I mean, there's no kind of attempt to come back to sort of let's work together at all, you know?
What's your take of Ron, I'm afraid of black people, Johnson? Where the hell does, I mean, you sit there and you go, this is what the thing about his interview, for folks who aren't familiar with it, Senator Ron Johnson, Wisconsin, gave an interview in which he made it very clear that he thought that the individuals who attacked the castle or the Capitol were, you know, they were good people who were, you know, just, they were, you know, concerned, and I had no concern about them and their coming to the Capitol, and I wasn't afraid of them, and they would not break the law as they were breaking the law. But then goes on to say, but if it were Black Lives Matter or Antifa, I would have been worried. But the thing that killed me, Bill, he said, I know I'm going to get in trouble for this. So, and then goes on to say it. To your point about the sort of the bold, brazen kind of in-your-face approach that is more so now than when Trump was there, how does that account? How do we account for that? What do we do with that? One side of me is I tweeted out when he said that was, thank you for the clarification. Now we know, one, that you think that white people love America more than black people. And two, you're afraid of black people. So thank you. I'm now clear. I understand it. Thank you for the clarification. So in one sense, the clarification makes the response that much easier. You're not sitting there trying to assess, well, what did he mean? And is he this or is he thinking that? No, he's very clear about it. But to your point, they just seem to be unashamed. It's like, whatever, this is what I'm thinking now, and y'all deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I never thought I'd say this, but Trump being in power might have constrained them a little, because he did have to sort of deal with the real world, which meant at times they couldn't really criticize Trump for being, like, not, you know, right-wing enough or not anti-immigrant enough, whereas now they're totally unmoored. They're in the minority. They have no power, and they can just sort of demagogue everything, apparently. But yeah, the fact that he said this about January 6th, too, which was the moment where one thought for a minute, for 24 hours, that this might bring Republicans back to reality and back to a little more responsibility. But look, you know, I mean, what's the most amazing about this is I know Ron Johnson some. I haven't seen him in 5 years, but I mean, I knew him. You were chairman.
Yeah.
In 2009, 2010. And we all, I think we sort of thought, you know, he's an outsider business type, kind of the fresh blood to kind of be helpful, maybe. And he seemed like a, you know, he wasn't the most sophisticated guy in the world, but Charlie Sykes, our friend, helped promote him there in Wisconsin when Charlie was the most prominent, you know, conservative talk radio person there. I don't know what has gone on that has turned Ron Johnson into this. It's one thing if you start off this way, frankly. If you're Marjorie Taylor Greene, I mean, I don't think there's any great difficulty in she's found
there's no
her moment.
There.
The world has moved to her, towards her craziness and towards her bigotry. So that's not like hard to explain, right?
Right.
But the Ron Johnson thing is a little bit as a sort of psychological matter. Like, what's going on? Did you know him fairly well in 2010 or just a little?
Yeah, no, we got to work because, you know, Reince, the chair of the party at the time was my general counsel. So I spent a lot of time in Wisconsin.
And he was chair of the Wisconsin, yeah.
He was chair of the Wisconsin party. And so I got, a lot of FaceTime with Ron and a lot of the political players there and got to know the state fairly well. And you're right, never came off as what we see now. I never would have expected that kind of a comment from him back then. So it does sort of beg the question, what the hell was in that arc? What changed? I mean, because Trump. If you can't put it all on Trump because he's not there any longer, and you make the good point that you know, while it was there, that may have constrained some of this. But for a guy like him, that was not something that he had a predilection towards politically. I'd never seen that before. So in one sense, I was really shocked, which is why I was like, well, thank you for the clarification, because I didn't know. Now I do. That you're not just doubling but tripling down on this in a way that I never thought possible. But okay, thank you. I now see it. And I don't know what pushes that and what's driving that. This is a guy who's looking to step down from public life. He's not. It's not like he's gearing up to run again. I mean, he's already put out there, I may not run again. I'm da 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 da. So what is it? What do you hope to gain if you leave the Senate in your private life by making statements like that? Because I can assure you, I'd be careful when that black waitress serves your food the next time that there is some extra DNA in it. Because what is the point here? I don't get what that's the thing. What is the point of making that kind of not just making the statement, Bill, but deliberately going out and saying, I know this is going to cause me trouble, but then on the back end complain about the fact that people complained about what you said.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the way I don't know the answer fully, obviously, but I guess one way to say it is there is no point in the way we normally think about that. There's no strategy, but he has internalized stuff that he maybe was sort of there 12 years ago. We didn't see it. It never came up. Who knows how he practiced, what his personal, I mean, what his like businesses will. I kind of suspect it wasn't there. That is, I suspect if the black employee came in to see Ron Johnson or whatever the company was that he owned, he was treated decently and, and fairly. But we don't know. I don't know that one way or the other. I don't want to presume the worst. But I think after all these years of internalizing the grievance and the ability to really demonize and denigrate people of other ethnicities and races, it sort of becomes internalized. And so I don't think he's sitting around thinking this is a clever thing for me to say. I think he's thinking, this is kind of what I believe, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think he believes that these people who came into the Capitol on January 6th are kind of the healthy part of America. They went a little far. I mean, they shouldn't dress up like lunatic, you know, people with horns and all this, but that's not his style. But they, you know, they're basically the good guys. And, you know, people who were demonstrating for, you know, against police brutality are the bad guys. And that's the world he's internalized, which is why I'm so pessimistic about the Republican Party. Ron Johnson is kind of, you know, he's not Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, in a certain way, why shouldn't we assume that he's kind of the average Republican senator at this point, and certainly closer to the average Republican House member, and not that far from some of the state legislators and stuff. That's another thing that's happened. You were lieutenant governor. These state legislatures, I mean, state legislators in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and the way they're behaving on voting and on other matters is a little bit, I mean, I can't believe those people thought that 5 or 10 years ago. 5 or 10 years ago, when you had a conversation with those people, they regretted the fact that African-Americans didn't, you know, join the Republican Party, that we didn't have more. They really, I think they were serious, earnest about that. They didn't really understand, perhaps, the resistance, the reluctance. They didn't think through some of their policy positions. But, you know, there was an earnest effort to sort of, I wish we had a bigger tent and so forth. And now that's just, I mean, the only way they're going to get a bigger tent is if they can find ways to appeal to grievances of minority groups even more and make them part of the aggrieved, you know, class of Americans, I suppose. But and some of that may work, incidentally, politically, but it's a heck of a way to build a party.
Yeah, there's no future in that. Before I let you get out of here, I'd like to get your final thought on a piece that you wrote back in February for The Bulwark. It was entitled, What Comes Next? And in it, you posed the question, and we touched on it at the beginning, but I think it'll be the perfect coda to this conversation and to sort of bookend it. You asked, how do we save and strengthen American liberal democracy? And you said the answer is put forward this way. Save the Republican Party, save the Democratic Party, start a new party, create a faction within or between parties, electoral reform, political reform, social media reform, and let's not forget civil society. You just went to your radical nature there, which I love. Are those the bricks that we should be laying now? Is that the path that we should be looking at as a country? as political activists, as intellectuals, as moms and pops, people who actually still fight for this ideal of America, to look at transforming the way we do these things in our political life and our civil life. How do you, what's the word you want to get out to folks in that space?
I mean, I guess the word I'd want to get out is there are a lot of paths that are necessary to pursue. And yesterday I happened to got involved in a conversation a couple of days ago about the evangelical community. It's not my world. I'm Jewish, but, you know, I know people in it. I've worked with them in it quite a lot. Right. And I said I'd make a couple of calls to see what was going on there, because this person was wanting to do something to break the movement of some of the evangelical churches, right, in a totally Trumpy direction, and the attempt to really suppress dissident voices in that world. And is there a way to strengthen those voices to give them a little reassurance they're not alone? So I just had conversations with a couple of old friends who are in that world. And they're very concerned and very interested in that, and I hope they're going to try to do some things. They already are doing some things informally, quietly. And it just made me think, you know what, there are a lot of, it's a very big country, and there are a lot of things have to happen in a lot of different areas at the national level, excuse me, at the state and local level, in different religious communities, in different parts of civil society, and then some policy areas. I mean, social media, I guess I don't think we're fated to have the social media we now have forever. I mean, these are things we can control to some degree. It's not easy to fix and to figure out, you know, what government telling Facebook what to do, but are we just doomed to forever live with algorithms that reward extremism and, and hatred and echo chamberism and so forth? So I'm, you know, I think people really need to move on whatever front they frankly are able to, and they're comfortable moving, and they have some ability to make a difference. And not everyone should go into electoral politics, and not everyone should avoid it either, though. And I do think politics matters, though. I don't think it can just be fixed at the civil society level. And that's where I think Biden's leadership, I guess I'll close with this, it does provide an opportunity, which some of our Republican friends don't. They're so automatically used to being Republicans. They fought Joe Biden forever. He was already a senator when you and I got involved, right?
Right, exactly.
They don't sort of, this is a pretty moderate Democrat governing after Trump. It's important for the country that he succeed. And, you know, he's a guy who wants to sort of make the country better, and wants to have an opposition, a loyal opposition he can deal with. And so taking Biden up on that offer and thinking hard about how to take advantage of the Biden presidency in a good way, as opposed to just reflexive criticism. I've been disappointed that even some people who were anti-Trump, I mean, who were, you know, not Trump apologists, just think, okay, our job is to go back into opposition. It's 1993 again, it's 2009 again. Leaving aside whether we were right or wrong, and we were both involved in those, I think we may have overdone it, frankly, in 1993 and 2009 in retrospect. Yeah. But whether that was right or wrong, whatever the effects of that were, it can't be the case now in 2021 that we just go into that kind of knee-jerk. Let's find something we don't like, something that's going wrong. The border situation looks difficult. Let's just scream and yell about that for a week in a demagogic way, instead of thinking, look, what can we work with the administration on? In what ways can we improve things? And if we have better ideas on the border, let's at least suggest them and propose them as legislation. And if Democrats want to not, then we can say, well, we had a better idea for what to do right now in March of 2021, not screaming and yelling about how they're for open borders, or they hate Americans, or they want to replace Americans. What was Tucker Carlson last night? You know, they hate the, they want to make America crowded with all these horrible immigrants and replace the country that he grew up in. I mean, that stuff is really pernicious and really poisonous, I've got to say. And that, for me, that's been the lesson of the 2-3 months, really the 4 or 5 months since the election. The degree of toxicity on the Republican and conservative side hasn't gone down. No. The fever hasn't broken. So for now, it just has to be defeated, frankly. And while we work on ways to get people back from that world that they got sucked into.
Well, I think it's good to have you at the tip of that spear. I'm happy to be there with you because I think you're right in terms of how we try to get in front of the country a different approach, a different pathway. And I think people, and we try to at least call it out for what it is. And I think people see it for what it is, and hope now that we can change the conversation. And I think it will start with the kind of leadership that we've seen from Joe Biden so far, because there does, I think, come a point where you hit a wall where what you're saying just isn't matched up with the facts. And so you can sit there and scream about brown kids coming across the border to take away the America you grew up in, but that's not going to be the reality that most Americans see, because what they will see is a child that needs to be, we need to be concerned about that child. We need to be concerned. So what are we going to do? We can demagogue against the kid all day long, but you still got to, the kid ain't going away. You still got to deal with the problem. And I think if you've got leadership that is prepared to deal with the problem, and a party that, like on our side, is willing to propose maybe alternative solutions, better solutions, or complementary solutions, that's the conversation I think the country is going to look for and need. Bill Kristol, Director of Defending Democracy Together, Editor at Large of the news and opinion website, The Bulwark, and host of the podcast Conversations with Bill Kristol. Thank you, man, for having a conversation here on the podcast today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael. I've really enjoyed it.
It's really good. And where can we follow you on Twitter, Bill? What's your Twitter
Bill,
handle?
At Bill, I think it's at Bill Kristol. Very simple.
There you go. Real straight up. At Bill Kristol. Follow him on Twitter. Check out The Bulwark, folks. Some really smart writing there. Great complement of opinion writers and news writers there. So all good stuff. And certainly hear more conversations with Bill Kristol on his podcast, Conversations with Bill Kristol. That does it for this week, folks. You know what you need to do. Do the download thing. You know I love it when you do the download. Makes me feel all yummy inside. Give us those good ratings. We love the ratings as well. Check us out on Apple, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcast. And until next time, take care of yourself. Wear the damn mask. Get the vaccination. All right? Not complicated. All right, until then, be safe, be well. Later.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. HealthMart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.